The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Don Crow. The Supreme Court lets the Texas law on abortion stand.
So we've never seen anything like this in the entire time that we've had Roe v. Wade.
In the run-up to the Winter Olympics in Beijing, human rights and religious liberty advocates are speaking up.
They are the biggest enabler of human rights abuses in the world, bar none.
As we approach Christmas, a challenge from Albert Mohler.
Never be too big, too old, or too cold to miss the sentiment of Christmas.
And how can we do that? How can we enjoy the season?
Sometimes we can, through intentionality, help reduce the stress a little bit.
We have all this and more. I'm your host, Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. Available at WAVA.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us today. We'll begin with Texas and the issue of abortion. In May this year, Texas Governor Abbott signed SB 8, a pro-life piece of legislation that is particularly bold in its effort to protect human life from about 6 weeks of pregnancy onward. There was no question it would be challenged in the courts. A week ago, the Supreme Court addressed a new round of legal challenges to the heartbeat bill. Kevin McCullough turned to Christina Bennett of Live Action from AM 570 The Mission in New York City.
I saw a statistic online that over the weekend, someone claiming that 77% of pro-life leadership is all male. And of course, there's this cheeky remark underneath it and says, and 100% of them will never have a baby. Well, I don't think that stat is correct. Because I know of so many women in leadership across the pro-life community, and Live Action is certainly one of those. And we used to check in regularly with Allison Centofante, our very good friend, but I think she's doing some mommy duty these days, which is another wonderful endeavor. And kind of doing what Allison used to do, a lot of the media appearances for Live Action, is Christina Bennett, who, if you're from Connecticut, you may know her from her work with the Family Institute there. I know that they had some connection to Focus on the Family. So there's always a good kind of relationship between these institutes across the country. But now she is kind of the full-time spokesperson with Live Action herself. And Christina, we're so grateful to get you on the show. But your own story, your own life starts in the middle of the pro-life issue. Describe.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be on. And yes, I'm from Connecticut. It's a very pro-choice state here, and so abortion was something that was never discussed in my own family, and I never heard it talked about at church growing up, so I wasn't a person that had a strong opinion on the issue. I was very ignorant until I was in college, and I found out that my mother actually walked out of her abortion appointment. She was being pressured by my father to abort me. She was rejected by a church mentor who found out that she was pregnant and not married. And a hospital janitor approached her when she'd paid for the abortion, was in the white robe, ready to go through with it, and told her that God would give her the strength to have me. And that gave my mom the courage to leave. She ended up going in to get her stuff. The doctor called her name, and she told him to his face that she was leaving. Now, he got very mad and yelled at her and said, "Don't leave this room. You've already paid for this." But she ran out and saved my life.
Wow. Wow. Christina, we could spend an hour just talking about the importance of mothers making that decision. But thank you for sharing that with us, because there is much more to unpack when you come back in the future. I want to talk about some of the news stuff that we've got to talk about today. And let me start with kind of the big items. Texas had its heartbeat law upheld last week. What does it mean? How does it impact the debate, at least in that one state? And does it have a chance to help shape the national debate beyond there? But let's start with what the Supreme Court decided.
Well, the Supreme Court decided that they are going to allow Texas's law to stand. They're not shutting it down. They are allowing, you know, individual abortion providers to sue, to go forward with their lawsuits, but they're not stopping the law. And so now we have over 100 days of this law having an impact on the state of Texas and on, you know, pregnant women in this state. What's really amazing is this is really like the third time that the Supreme Court has stood up for the state of Texas. The first time was when they didn't automatically have a ruling. And then again, they allowed it to stand when they were asked to vote on it. And now for the third time, they're saying that the law can continue to stand. And so we've never seen anything like this in the entire time that we've had Roe v. Wade. Since 1973, we've never seen a state get this far, and for this law to continue to stand is really inspirational for other states. And there's about 20 states or so that are looking at Texas. You know, obviously Mississippi is one of them, and legislation of their own that is, you know, before the Supreme Court right now. But there's about 20 southern states that are looking at Texas as an example and wanting to follow their lead with similar legislation.
What is your takeaway in terms of what abortion looks like maybe a year from now?
Well, there's no denying that President Trump made a difference when it comes to the Supreme Court. There's no, whatever anyone has to say about him or think about him, he did what he promised, and he gave us three, you know, pro-life justices, and we're already seeing the impact of that in amazing ways. Just the fact that when they were talking about, you know, the Mississippi case, the Dobbs case, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, she was asking about adoption. She was bringing up safe haven laws. Even Justice Roberts was talking about how extreme the rest of the world, or how extreme America is compared to the rest of the world when it comes to abortion, how most of Europe and many other nations don't even allow abortions after 20 weeks. And here we are, you know, allowing abortions all the way up until 9 months. So I'm very hopeful for this Mississippi case. I'm very hopeful. I am believing that the justices are going to stand, not all of them, but I believe that the conservative ones are going to stand with the state of Mississippi and allow this 15-week abortion ban to continue on. And I think that that is going to be really the beginning of the end for Roe v. Wade.
In less than 30 seconds, what is a pro-choice man, and what are they all about, and why are they on social media right now?
Well, Live Action just made a really phenomenal video. It's satire. And we are, you know, poking fun, but really we're trying to expose the mentality that pro-choice men have, where they say that they support women's rights because that's the, you know, right thing to do, supporting women's rights, as in abortion. That's what they mean by that. But really, it's just an excuse for them to alleviate their own responsibility when it comes to fatherhood and being a man and defending women and defending children. And so when they say that they support abortion rights, really they're just putting the burden of responsibility on women and saying, you know, your body, your choice, you take care of this. I'm out of here, and I'm free to be promiscuous or to have sex with whoever I want and to not have to bear the responsibility of fatherhood. And so we have a video on our social media, on our Instagram and Facebook, that's poking fun at that, but in a serious way to expose how awful it is.
December 10th marked Human Rights Day, a day marking the date the United Nations signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Sam Brownback has been a bold voice for the most fundamental of human freedoms, beginning with the freedom of religion. The former ambassador at large for international religious freedom under President Trump was a guest on my program, talking about some of the troubles in the world and the persecution that's ongoing, human rights violations. No one more culpable or more guilty of it, perhaps, than China. U.S. officials, for example, boycotting the Beijing Olympics. That's just one story among several. But Congressman, talk about that, if you would, as to China's overall really total disregard for human rights anywhere in the world, but even among their own, or maybe especially among their own people.
They are the biggest enabler of human rights abuses in the world, bar none. They are it. They cause or do more human rights abuses than anybody else in the world, and maybe all the rest of the world combined. I'm just really disappointed that they wanted to ascend to global leadership with such an abysmal record. They've got a genocide going on right now in Xinjiang in western China. They tear down house churches. They've got organ harvesting of Falun Gong and Uyghurs. And then they enable human rights abuses in many places, North Korea, Afghanistan. Now they're back in the Taliban, much of Africa, some of the difficulties there. And then they're the future of oppression. They're using high-tech equipment, artificial intelligence, facial recognition systems. This is going to be the virtual police state of the future, and they're operating it now and are going to give it away to authoritarian regimes.
And what about this recent development that U.S. officials are going to boycott the Olympics, the diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Games or Winter Olympics in Beijing? This whole issue, will this have any impact on China? And is it really the right course of action, or is there something far more that we should be doing?
I think it's a good step, and I'm glad they did it, and I'm glad they did it and associated it with human rights abuses, both in Xinjiang and Hong Kong. It just needs to be more. We need Western advertisers now to step up and say to China, either close the concentration camps down, or we're pulling our advertising dollars. Coca-Cola, Airbnb, and these others should be saying that right now. And we need to be calling on the UN. The UN Secretary General shouldn't be going to the Olympics when they have an ongoing genocide, as we've determined and a British tribunal came out with last week. You shouldn't honor a country or line its pockets when it's got a genocide going on.
How do you explain that kind of power among the global community, Ambassador, certainly among the high-tech and the corporate industries and world, and also some of these world leaders? How do you explain their willingness to capitulate to China?
Either it's hypocrisy or a huge double standard.
Yeah.
If the United States or France, Great Britain, was doing what China is doing now, if we had a million Muslims locked up and told by law you can't name your child Muhammad, they would be screaming bloody murder, the UN officials, the world community, and yet China has it and they look the other way. These companies would be doing the same thing. They'd be screaming bloody murder if we did it, or France, Great Britain, and yet they look the other way for China. It's a huge either hypocrisy or a double standard.
The average American, I think, feels very frustrated because we feel like our lone voices, if you will, toward corporate America, for example, really, they can afford to ignore us, it seems. How can the average listener engage in this effort to really try to create some pressure somewhere?
You know, they can contact these companies. I mean, they can email them.
Yep.
And if enough start doing that, and then they can stop buying their product. I know it would seem like a drop in the ocean, but you'd feel better yourself, and maybe it starts a movement to where these companies will start listening a little bit.
Coming up, we'll turn to Christmas.
Never be too big, too old, or too cold to miss the sentiment of Christmas.
Stay with us. The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire...
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. The Christmas holiday is now on us. There are a multitude of things pulling at us. Our to-do list, our desire to see Christ remain the center of the holiday, and on and on. But don't let anything prevent you from enjoying the season. Here's Albert Mohler defending the sentimentality of Christmas from his briefing.
in the history of the Christian church, one of the towering figures who was always ready to defend the Christian faith, even if it cost him his life. We're talking about Martin Luther. He also pointed to the sweetness of Christmas. He was not afraid of sentimentality. This Teutonic German theologian who so defended the Christian faith, he also defended the sentiment of Christmas. Now, maybe part of this was because Martin Luther was a husband and he was a father. He loved celebrating Christmas with his young children and his wife. He loved celebrating Christmas as a family. And of course, many of the Christian traditions we know right now were born in Germany, in German culture, especially in the aftermath of the Reformation. We come to understand that Luther helps to remind us that sentiment is necessary. And this is where, as we read the biblical text, we have to see the sentiment that is actually revealed in the text. In Matthew and in Luke, in all of Scripture, but particularly about the birth of Jesus, in those two Gospels, there is sweetness. There is the tenderness of Joseph for Mary. There's the tenderness of heart of Mary as she is addressed by the angel Gabriel, and she responds with submission and obedience. There's the tenderness, most especially, of the birth of this baby, the lowly nature of this birth. This is the very second person of the Trinity, the very Son of God. This is the eternal Logos who created the world. Yes, it is this very Son who became the baby in Bethlehem's manger, who condescended, was so humble as to become the Son of Mary, and of course, who came into the world not with the grandeur of the birth of a king the world would immediately recognize, but rather with the humility of the one who would be the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the same yesterday, today, and forever. And yet that tiny infant in his mother's arms, and yes, in the manger laid, that tiny infant is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the Savior who is Christ the Lord. And yet, as we close, a final remembrance of the sweetness of Christmas. And this comes in the very hand of Martin Luther, a song we believe was written for his own children at Christmas. It still exists in his handwriting. He concludes this song, "From heaven high, I come to you," with these words. "This king is but a little child, his mother blessed, Mary mild. His cradle is but now a stall, yet he brings joy and peace to all. Now let us all with songs of cheer follow the shepherds and draw near to find this wondrous gift of heaven, the blessed Christ, whom God hath given." And so to each of you, Merry Christmas, to every home, to every family, to every listener, yes, to every ear. Celebrate Christmas in all of its wonder, in all of its glory, in all of its grandeur. May you know a Christmas that is filled with the glory of Christ. May you affirm and embrace, and may you proclaim in every way every truth claim concerning Jesus that is revealed in Scripture. Tell the wholeness of the story of Christ. Teach it to your children and your grandchildren. Sing Christmas carols and sing them with gusto. And never be too big, too old, or too cold to miss the sentiment of Christmas. True Christians see the sentiment, more than sentiment, but never less than the sentiment. Don't miss the glory of Christmas. Merry Christmas to you all.
Yes, we should not miss the glory of Christmas, but our heart desire to adore and enjoy Christ and savor the season can easily get crowded out. Gavin Ortland, a pastor in Ojai, California, shared some practical advice in his conversation with John Hall and Kathy Emmons on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
So have we been sold then, you know, sort of this false dream that because it is the Christmas season and Christmas coming up, that all of us should be floating on a pink cloud of joy? And if we're not, then somehow we're seriously flawed.
Yeah, well, it does seem like sometimes we have that pressure, you know. And one thing that's helped me is just trying to be extra intentional to do everything that is within my power. And there's some things that we can't control. You know, the certain seasons of life can get very busy, and it's not within our power to necessarily do much about that. But sometimes we can, through intentionality, help reduce the stress a little bit and really cultivate joy. And so that's what I've decided to do personally each year at Christmas. I take the whole month of December, and there's a couple things I do to try to do whatever I can, you know, whatever is within my power to make it a joyful season, not a stressful time.
Mm. Okay, and so what concrete choices do you make?
Okay, so some of these are very simple, but they do help. One of them is whenever I'm waiting somewhere, I don't pull out my phone. Now, I have to confess my sins. Sometimes I forget, and I'll find myself looking at my phone, and I'll think, oh, no, and I'll put it back in my pocket. But I just find that, you know, things often are busier and busier and busier, and the clutter in my mind that happens from constantly having my phone on me to distract me is just a continual battle. So I've decided December is going to be a time where I'm just going to try to scale it back one notch. I don't try to go crazy on that. It's just, you know, if I'm at the dentist or something like that, I just, you know, like the old days, when you're waiting somewhere, you're actually waiting. You know, you're not trying to multitask, which for me really helps.
Right. This has been a challenge for me over the last couple of weeks, Gavin. It's really funny that you're doing the same thing. I was challenged to do that by a friend that I work with, and it was an Advent challenge. It said, if you want to see how bad we are at waiting, then for the next week, whenever you're waiting for anything, at a stoplight, in a line at the grocery store, retail, whatever, you can't look at your phone.
Right.
Well, I felt like someone cut off my arm.
I'm just glad to know I'm not the only one.
Oh, my gosh. And then I hated myself. I thought, how have I allowed this to happen? Even today. So I've been doing it for a week, and oftentimes I get really disappointed in myself because I forget my intentionality, and then I find myself waiting in line looking at my phone, and then I say, no, you're supposed to put it away. And then today I got in the elevator, and I seriously get on the elevator and I reach for it like I'm Pavlov's dog.
Right.
I've been so trained, it's hard.
I know. I I'm just glad that I'm not the only one who has that experience, because then I feel guilty and I think, wow, look how hooked I am. It's just instinct to check my phone when I'm waiting, but it's a simple thing. So I try to just not take it as, try to not let it induce guilt, but just see it as whenever I remember that, just be mindful of that, put the phone down, slow down as much as I can. So that's just one simple thing that I've done. And then we just try to go easy on the kids. We try to spoil them a little bit. We do some fun things with them. I try to work a little bit less when I can. And then the biggest thing is whatever passage I'm preaching on, I just take it and have a little extended time in the mornings just to reflect upon that. I'm preaching through some of the early parts of Luke. This week is on Simeon, who's the character who blesses the baby Jesus when he's brought into the temple. And I just take a little extra time to reflect upon what the experience was of these people at the time of the birth of Jesus, and how amazing, how joyful. I just have this image in my mind of Simeon, this old man who's, you know, the Holy Spirit showed him he would hold the Messiah one day, maybe he's 80 years old or something, and just the thought of holding the baby Jesus in his arms when Jesus is 40 days old, and the joy, and because he says, now my eyes have seen your salvation, and the thought of this little baby is God's salvation. So I'm just always trying to redirect from the details back to the meaning of it all, and meditating on those stories really helps me do that.
Coming up, screen time. Too much screen time.
This is displacing more important things. It's displacing our attention for our children. It's displacing prayer. It's getting in the way of real life.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. Kathy Emmons, in our last segment, had a helpful moment of candor in their conversation with Gavin Ortland. That is, her efforts to set her heart on Christ are hindered by her instinctive or Pavlovian twitch to pick up her phone. The point, for many of us, even when we want to, we have a hard time getting away from our screens. We are, in the title of the book by our next guest, Drowning in Screen Time. David Murrow joined Bob Lapine on KKLA in Los Angeles.
How do we regulate our own lives so that we can use the tool without the tool consuming us?
Well, let me get to a foundational comment that I come up with Christians all the time. A lot of believers think that if we just stay away from the bad stuff, that we don't have a screen problem. Just stay away from the porn, the bad language, the violence, all these sorts of things, you know, the devil stuff. And then we're fine. But the problem is not even so much, that's definitely a problem, the immoral content. But what I'm seeing with Christians now is We are watching so many hours every day of screen content, whether it's cable news or surfing the web or time on social media, that this is displacing more important things. It's displacing our attention for our children. It's displacing prayer. It's getting in the way of real life. It's pushing real life away. And one of the parables that I use in the beginning of my book is the parable of the Matrix. Everybody's familiar with that movie. You know, we all plug ourselves into a giant machine that simulates reality for us. And I always wondered, well, how could the machines trick us into plugging ourselves into this alternate reality? Well, guess what? It's coming. It's called the metaverse.
Yeah.
It's right around the corner. And there's billions of dollars behind it. And as Christians, we have to stay grounded in real life, in the real world. We cannot cede our attention to the electronic world, or we're going to fail as followers of Christ, as men and women. And that's the warning bell that I'm ringing.
For people who have heard that term, the metaverse, and heard Facebook is becoming Meta, and this is where we're headed, but they go, I don't know what that means or what I should be alert to. Have you got your arms wrapped around that? Can you explain that to us?
Well, I do. A couple of movies would help. If you've ever seen The Matrix, or there's another one called Ready Player One. I don't know if you saw that movie.
Yeah.
But it describes an immersive world where people wear headsets and live the vast majority of their existence in this artificial realm. And there are rewards, and you get coins, and those translate to real-life rewards. And it's just a seeding of real life. And the world that they exist in is kind of a dystopian future. They live in buses and RVs and stacked on top of each other. And that's one of the things that the media world kind of tends to do to us. It tells us 7-8 hours a day that the world is falling apart and you need to retreat into our products to escape from this terrible world we live in. So, you know, it kind of goes hand in hand. All the media companies have two divisions. They've got a news division to scare you, and then they've got an entertainment division to soothe you once you're scared. So they make money coming and going. But if you think about screen time 100 years ago, if you wanted screen time in 1921, you had to go to a movie theater. And you were there for, you know, maybe 90 minutes or however long the movie lasted. And then you metaphorically took the movie off and you spent the other 166 hours a week in real life. Well, that's where we are right now with the metaverse. You put the things on, you're on for a couple hours, and then you're off. But the future of the metaverse is, and what these tech entrepreneurs are seeing, is a world where we never take the glasses off, or we very rarely do, you know, maybe to take a shower or something. But we live in this artificial realm. And quite frankly, a lot of people are pushing back, and rightly so.
Why is it so enticing for us? I do this. You know, if I've got 30 seconds of downtime, my natural impulse is to reach for my phone and check something. Why is that what I'm so inclined to do these days?
Well, in the book, I start with five different parables, and two of them are based around the biblical character of King David. Before David was a king, you know, he was a humble shepherd boy. And so I tell the story about how he's out just tending his sheep and nothing much ever happens. But then all of a sudden, a wolf shows up in the flock, and his brain goes into hyperarousal, and he pulls out a stone and he repels the wolf by, you know, his famous slingshot and all this. And I talk about the metabolic changes that happen when something new happens. And this is how God created us. We have a very advanced surveillance and warning system when we see new things. Because novelty is always something that you can eat or something that can eat you. Our brains are designed for a monotonous world with a little bit of novelty, and we respond very strongly to that. Well, until 2007, novelty was something still that was novel. But now we have an unlimited supply of novelty in our pockets. We can literally summon wolves anytime we want. And that keeps our brains in a state of hyperarousal. And that may be one of the reasons why we're so tired, why we're getting so depressed. We keep stimulating our brains with novelty and this dopamine shot. But our brains were not meant to be on high alert or high stimulation all the time. And it's really wreaking havoc, especially with younger people.
Coming up, gaming.
It's a very attractive escape for men, and it keeps them from participating in real life.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. For all of us who are parents or grandparents, there's a natural tendency to see how bad this issue of screen time is for other people, and conveniently look past the log in our own eye. Let's return to more of the conversation between Bob Lapine and David Murrow, author of Drowning in Screen Time.
Who's this book written for, David?
The target audience for my book, like pastors, for example, who are dealing with these issues in the church, youth ministers, teachers who are dealing with these issues in the classroom, and of course, parents.
Yeah.
And the primary advice I give to parents is before you start to intervene on behalf of your children, you need to make sure that your nose is clean as well. We're hearing from a lot of kids that they are feeling ignored by their parents because their parents are either, you know, trying to photograph everything for Instagram so they can win social media, or they're on their they're watching TV while they're on their laptops and they've got their phone next to them, and they are ignoring their kids. And there's another phenomenon that I describe in the book called being alone together. And this is where families have family time, but everybody's got their own device. So they're physically present, but their brains are in the metaverse. And so we really got to avoid that, that sort of dysfunction, or it will bring your family down.
I'm thinking about parents of teens because I mean, I see teenagers on devices almost nonstop. There's a, well, I don't think they're listening, so I think this is okay to say. A young person who works at our church and does the slides during Sunday morning worship keeps the lyrics up in front of people. And I noticed one Sunday that the song lyrics weren't on the screen right. And I found out, oh, she'd been distracted by her. By her screen, by her phone. It's endemic that among teenagers, that link to the device is almost like they need a surgical removal.
Yes. Well, I mean, and it's a different strategy for young children than older, you know, the teens. Once that genie's out of the bottle, it's very hard to put it back in. With the young kids, start from a very early age. First of all, never give them their own screen device. Don't put a TV in their bedroom. Don't give them one of these little laptops or tablets. Because what that does is that gets them used to being lord of their own personal digital kingdom. Hmm. Whenever they're bored, they can immediately turn to a screen that is their own. And that habituates them to going to a screen anytime they want a shot of dopamine.
So an iPad or a Kindle device for an 8-year-old, you're saying, don't do that?
Terrible idea. Yeah, because you're training them at the moment of boredom to go to a screen rather than to go to their toy box or go to a friend or go build a relationship or go outside and build a treehouse, the things we used to do when we were kids, you know?
Right.
Those activities are still possible, and they're tremendously helpful, but they're being, again, preempted by screen time. So don't let kids have their own devices. One of the advices I give to parents is you want to implement screen-free evenings.
Okay, the parents who are going to be going on a road trip for Christmas and who are thinking the only way we survive between here and wherever we're going, 5 hours in the car, is if the 3-year-old has got a screen to look at. Is that okay if we do that just, you know, as a survival technique to get from point A to point B in the car?
Well, let me make a distinction. There's two types of screen time. There's interactive screen time and passive screen time. And one revs the brain up way more than the other. Passive screen time is watching a movie. You don't interact with the movie at all. You just simply watch a movie as presented by the filmmaker. Interactive screen time would be social media, creating things on the computer, and video gaming. That's where you're actually manipulating things on the screen. And what researchers are finding is that interactive media is much more addictive, much harder on the brain, much more strain, and puts way more strain on our mental resources, and will lead us to feel fatigued or depressed or whatever. So if you want to, you know, pop in a couple of movies for your kids while you're traveling, or as a calm down time after school, that's not going to be nearly as bad for them as if you just hand them a game controller and let them go crazy on games for 8 hours. So, yeah, if you're driving across country, go ahead, pick a couple of really good movies, let them watch those. But I would really caution you with interactive screen time, because that's really going to rev their brains up.
We've been talking about iPhones and iPads and those kinds of screens. I want to talk about video gaming, which, David, it seems to me this is more of an issue with parents who are raising sons than parents who are raising daughters. But there's, I was checking this out, the DSM-5, the medical journal, has video game addiction as an entry for doctors. And there are treatment centers for people who are addicted to video games. This has become something in the last 10 to 20 years that's become very serious, hasn't it?
Yeah. Boys are heavier console gamers. They find their community online with games. They put these headphones on and they have, you know, racy boy type conversations. They feel like they can't quit the game because they'd be quitting their friends. And if you think about all the roles that have been stripped away from men, you know, a lot of us are no longer warriors, heroes, or fighters anymore. You know, we work in tech jobs, but then we get into our avatar and we're this big buff, you know, alien killing machine. You know, we get to fulfill all these male roles that have been taken away from men in the last 100 years, and we get to be these heroes that we're not in real life. And so, you know, with the marginalization of masculinity and these sorts of things, it's a very attractive escape for men, and it keeps them from participating in real life.
So would you say an Xbox in the home is a no-no, or would you say it's just one of those tools that you can have it and have some fun with it, just put the guardrails up around it?
Yeah, parental guidance limits is definitely important. There is software for these machines now that can disconnect them from the Internet at certain times. There are routers that will disconnect them. You can give your kids a certain amount of time on their machines. So, yeah, it's about the guardrails. It's about the games they play. And you need to be very careful if they're speaking to people over headphones, because I'm just talking to my friend. Well, that may not be a friend on the other line. That could be a predator.
Yeah.
So you need to be very, very, very careful about who they're speaking to online.
And the specific games, some of these games are very violent, and some of them are very pornographic, aren't they?
They are. So that would be, but, you know, that would be something you could see just by seeing the screen. So, yeah, you need to put your foot down. You need to, you know, focus on the family as a great resource for parents that are wanting to evaluate movies and video games. And you can go on their website, you can type in the name, and they'll tell you, you know, if they pass Focus's standard for that sort of thing. So there, you know, the good thing is, as Christian parents, there are resources online. Go to your screen and briefly check them, and you can find out whether these things are going to be acceptable for your kid.
Coming up, a screen time Sabbath.
Focus on eliminating that mindless screen time.
In the final segment of the Christian Outlook, stay with us.
And ransom captive Israel.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. The Jewish Sabbath starts at sundown on Friday evening and continues to sundown on Saturday night. For the Orthodox Jews, they do not use cars or take elevators or use any mechanical device during that Sabbath period. Our guest, David Murrow, sees a lesson here for where we are with our screens. Here's Bob Lapine.
You talked about screen-free evenings. To take a screen fast, whether it's a day or a half day, or to take a longer period than that, that can be soul cleansing. I mean, people think of that and go, I could never do that. And then they do it and they come back and go, it kind of reawakened something that I'd forgotten was in there.
Well, and, you know, Christians have the perfect example for that, a screen Sabbath. If you want to take Sunday off from your screen, you know, attend worship, see your friends, and then just take the afternoon off, unless your favorite football team is playing. You can make an exception, but at least put the interactive devices down for a day. It is tremendously soul cleansing to take a day away from your screen and intentionally live in the real world, because that's how God designed us. And that's where everything we really want in life is in the real world. You know, if we want to be in a successful relationship, we have to be in the real world. If we want to advance in our career, we need to be in the real world. If we want to advance the kingdom of God and tell people about Jesus, we need to do that in the real world. And that's where health is. That's where life is. And so I do recommend a weekly Sabbath from screens. And those people who are practicing that, and I can speak as somebody who does that pretty regularly, it's been tremendously helpful.
So sell me on the benefits of that. A screen Sabbath for you, how does that help you?
What I do is I put my phone away Saturday night. I pick it back up Sunday night because I've got to get ready for work. But so it's like a Jewish Sabbath, you know, sundown to sundown.
Right.
And how it works is I just simply don't read the news. I don't check my email. I do enjoy NFL football games if my team is playing.
Right.
And so I will make an exception to watch a game, but I'll only do that in a recreational, in a sense. And it's not interactive media. It's not really getting my brain up. And I have a pretty good team. They usually win, so I don't get stressed out. So, that would be the one exception. I don't in the spring and summer, I don't even watch any screen content on Sunday. It's time with my wife. It's time. If the phone rings and I get a FaceTime call, I'm going to use that. But again, that's not the type of screen time that you want to preempt. It's that mindless screen time. And, you know, people always say, Dave, what's the first step in conquering your screen time? I can get you to the 50-yard line real quick. Just focus on eliminating that mindless screen time, turning on your TV when you come in, that those moments at baggage claim when you pick up your phone. If you can just stay in the real world, look around, open your eyes, pray for people around you, you're already halfway to getting healthy with screens.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. If you enjoyed the program, be sure to tell a friend and sign up for our podcast at ChristianOutlook.com. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Schubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Pouchon, Mike Cook and Alex Perez, I'm Don Crow, wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas. May your celebration be richly blessed.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.